loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, in an interview with the Washington Post yesterday, Vice President Pence said that if China wants to avoid what he called an all-out Cold War with the United States and its partners, it must fundamentally change its behavior. The comments came in advance of President Trump's meeting later this month with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Next, British Prime Minister Theresa May told Parliament today that the country is, quote, significantly closer, unquote, to delivering on Brexit, saying that the draft agreement reached with the European Union would give the UK control of its borders, laws, and money. She is seeking the backing of her senior-most ministers today before putting the agreement to a parliamentary vote. Then, Jamel Roberson was shot by police in a Chicago suburb earlier this week. He was a black security guard who was on duty the night a shooter came into a bar where he worked. He successfully had the alleged shooter on the ground when cops arrived, but instead of taking the shooter into custody, the police shot Roberson, the security guard, and killed him. And then protesting students in Colombia are preparing for a major demonstration tomorrow as they continue their struggle for adequate funding for the country's higher education. They're facing massive violent repression from the new far-right government of Iván Duque. And finally, President Trump today named the former commander of Central Command, General John Abizade, as the new ambassador to Saudi Arabia. The appointment came as a surprise, as Abizade has no direct ties to Trump, and the Saudis insist that any U.S. ambassador be a direct line to the president. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to China. In an interview with the Washington Post yesterday, Vice President Pence said that if China wants to avoid what he called an all-out Cold War with the United States and its partners, it must fundamentally change its behavior. The comments came in advance of President Trump's meeting later this month with Chinese President Xi Jinping. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Hi there.
Jude, why the bluster all of a sudden?
Well, it's a little unclear, isn't it? I mean, this is a follow-up to Pence's speech on the 4th of October at the Hudson Institute, which was widely seen as announcing a full frontal Cold War stance with China. That follows itself from the publication of the National Defense Strategy at the beginning of this year, which obviously changes the priorities of US foreign and security policy. It states clearly that the priority is no longer the war on terror, but the priority is what it calls interstate competition. And if you're unclear what that means, it goes on to say that means China and Russia. And it was widely said that the new defense procurement, which is classified and we don't know exactly what's in it, was worked out on the basis of how to win a war with China. So this is not something that's just popped up out of the blue. It's been building over this year and obviously includes the trade war, which kicked off back in May.
I'm looking at the interview that Pence gave to Josh Rogan, columnist for The Washington Post. I want to read a couple sentences to you, Jude Woodward. Pence told me, this is Rogan speaking, the journalist from The Post, told me in an interview that Trump is leaving the door open for a deal with Xi, the president of China, in Argentina, but only if Beijing is willing to make massive changes that the United States is demanding to its economic, military, and political activities. The vice president said that this is China's best, if not last, chance to avoid a Cold War scenario with the United States. He goes on, I think much of that will depend on Argentina, Pence said. The president's attitude is we want to make sure that they know where we stand, what we are prepared to do, so that they can come to Argentina with concrete proposals that address not just the trade deficit that we faced. In addition to trade, Pence said China must offer concessions on several issues, including but not limited to its, quote, rampant intellectual property theft, forced technology transfer, restricted access to Chinese markets, respect for international rules and norms, efforts to limit freedom of navigation in international waters, and Chinese Communist Party interference in the politics of Western countries. I mean, when you look at that list, Jude Woodward, you'd have to come to the conclusion that that's not really a negotiating position. That's presenting a list of demands, far-reaching demands that China, no Chinese president could possibly say yes to.
Of course. I think it was put very well by Martin Wolf, chief economics editor, commentator of the Financial Times. He's no particular friend of China, who said that the U.S. demands for the lifting of the tariffs amounted to the U.S. will be judge, jury, and executioner, while China is deprived of the right to retaliate or seek recourse. And he went on to say, no great sovereign power could accept such a humiliation. For China, it would be a modern version of the unequal treaties of the 19th century. So it's a complete fake. It's not a negotiating basis at all. On that basis, there will be no agreement in Argentina. I'm not holding my breath. I'm not expecting there to be anything. I think you're in a situation where this full frontal offensive against China has won out as the policy of the administration for the time being. I think the only things that are likely to impact on that are if the voices of US big business becomes rowdy enough on the problems that the tariffs are causing. We've already got problems being posed for some sections of US farming because of the retaliatory tariffs that China has imposed. And if the domestic inflation in commodities and so on begins to impact on American working people, creating political problems, then we may see some shift on the tariffs question. But I don't anticipate some shift on this overall hostile stance in the short term unless there's some geopolitical change that brings it about.
Jude Woodward is our guest. We're talking to Jude from London about the U.S.-China trade war, but more than a trade war. Mike Pence has declared basically war, maybe not open military war, but certainly making a presentation on China such that the United States is positioning itself, and I would say positioning or trying to position the American people to accept a major confrontational position between the United States and the People's Republic of China. Here's an article, Jude. U.S. farmers scramble to contain trade war damage and find new markets. This is from Reuters. Crowds gathered the Illinois sky as Nick Hare walked away from his combine at the peak of harvest to join four fellow farmers in greeting some unlikely visitors. The wooing of such a tiny market that is Sri Lanka. They're bringing over Sri Lankan trade delegations because they can't sell soybeans as a consequence of China's retaliation on American agricultural products.
And it's not as though the Sri Lankan market can absorb what the Chinese market was handling.
It's tiny. It's tiny. Jude Woodward, go ahead. I mean, Sri Lanka, just for our listeners, they bought 3,000 metric tons of soybeans in all of last year. That's Sri Lanka.
Well, exactly. And China, I'm looking at the same article as you. China bought 32 million tons. So
32 million versus 3,000 metric tons.
I mean, this is a real problem because the problem you've got for U.S. soybean farming is that there have been bumper harvests. The prices are already falling internationally. And now you've got their main market disappearing. So this is creating the kind of disruption that one would anticipate, the boomerang impact of not just the tariffs themselves, but the retaliatory measures on the U.S. U.S. producers.
Jude Woodward is our guest. Jude, it seems to me when we talk about the national security strategy, that's what you're referring to. It makes it very, very clear that what's happening between the United States and China is not simply Donald Trump simply playing to his base with the Make America Great Again. If it's not the origin, it certainly dovetails with a larger, major reorientation of U.S. foreign and military policy. I mean, when we think about it, since Deng Xiaoping came and met with Jimmy Carter in 1979, and even after the Tiananmen Square, shortly after the Tiananmen Square events of June 1989, the U.S. government has more or less adopted a friendly pose towards China, certainly a normalized pose. And all of a sudden, And it's really with sort of a dynamism that would have been hard to have predicted a few years ago. All of that is out the window. And now China is not only a, quote, competitor rather than a partner, it's actually being targeted as an existential threat to the existence of the United States as a major power and as a consequence targeted. Really something.
Well, yes, quite. Though we should be clear, this really began under Obama and Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Stateship with the so-called pivot to Asia and her speech in Hanoi in 2010, if memory serves me correctly, when she announced the US was going to step up its military, effectively announced the US was stepping up its military presence in the South China Sea and that the US was coming back as a military presence in areas which it had basically pulled back from. The problem that Obama then confronted was, one, the US was still deeply mired in the Middle East. Then you had the Arab Spring, which presented both challenges and opportunities for the US, which absorbed attention and resources. Then you had the situation in Ukraine. So under Obama or under Hillary Clinton and her successors, that turn to confronting China was never fully carried through, although the tactics were different from the tactics now advocated by Trump, because they were more about a carrot and a stick and about engaging partners, whereas this is Trump's stance is much more the US is just going to stand up to China and its friends and allies can like it or lump it. But essentially, this has been building up for 8 years, and we're now reaching a very critical point, which is dangerous for China, but is dangerous for the whole world.
That was Jude Woodward. She is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. British Prime Minister Theresa May told Parliament today that the country is, quote, significantly closer, close quote, to delivering on Brexit, saying that the draft agreement reached with the European Union would give the UK control of its borders, laws, and money. However, she faces sharp opposition within and outside of her own party that could still bring down her government. We are joined from London by Steve Keen. Steve is the author of Debunking Economics, and he is the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out and support his work at patreon.com/Prof Steve Keen, and Keen is K-E-E-N. Steve Keen, welcome back.
Good to be here, mate.
Thank you for joining. Momentous day today, but there are other momentous days coming this week for Theresa May. What did she tell the cabinet? Does she have their support? What is the basic outline of this agreement?
I think she summarized herself pretty well when she said it's, in some ways, the closest economic cooperation you can get without freedom of movement. And I think she's trying to hit the sweet spot between the people who are rabid Brexiters and those who are rabid Remainers. And the Brexiters, the main complaint they've had, apart from sort of issues of sovereignty, is free movement. That's really what's led to a lot of the opposition in the declining what used to be the industrial heartland of the UK. So this stops free movement. It enables people who've had some residency, EU citizens living in the UK and vice versa, to continue that. But it also maintains them as part of the customs union, and it's trying to avoid a hard border in Northern Ireland, which is probably the most contentious part of all. And frankly, I think it's the part which has actually forced the EU to be reasonable about this and agree to preventing one of the so-called pillars of the European Union, which is free movement of labour and capital.
Right. So let's talk about Northern Ireland just for a quick second, because I want to get more into the economic implications, sort of big picture for what this means for the UK. But in terms of Northern Ireland, what Northern Ireland shares a soft border with the Republic of Ireland. That's a consequence of the agreements ending the war in Ireland between the IRA and the British government. The Northern Ireland now, as a consequence of this agreement, appears to be sort of still in the EU, although it's not, although it's part of the, a part of Britain, part of the UK. It stays inside the EU at least for the foreseeable future, meaning it won't have a hard border with the Republic of Ireland, which, of course, is still in the EU. That's kind of the rub of it, right?
When you spend some time and you pass through that part of the world, you realize that the tensions which were ended by the agreements 20-something years ago are really quite tenuous. And the potential for conflict to break out between the Catholics and the Protestants is still very vividly there. So a large part of the desire to prevent a physical border being re-established across those North versus South Ireland is to prevent that level of conflict being triggered once more. So, and of course, this was made even a greater imperative for the Theresa May's government when she foolishly thought she could destroy the Labour Party by calling a snap election about a year ago and finding herself being totally out-campaigned by Jeremy Corbyn, and ending up, rather than increasing her majority and wiping out Corbyn, or eliminating her majority and becoming dependent upon an extreme right-wing Protestant group that wants to avoid Northern Ireland being joined with Southern Ireland. So it's a right royal mess, of course. But I think this particular agreement possibly prevents that warfare breaking out again. So I'm not opposed to the way this agreement's been formed.
Of course, there are other parts of the UK, including Scotland, not just Northern Ireland. And Scotland clearly voted to stay in the EU, the people in Scotland. And now you have the Scottish party led by Nicola Sturgeon saying, well, look, if Northern Ireland can stay basically inside the EU to prevent a new conflict breaking out in Ireland, whatever the reason, and Scotland wants to really stay in the EU too, this is a bad deal for Scotland. Is it possible that it will contribute to additional centrifugal forces within the UK?
I don't think so, because the economic side of it is saying that the whole of the UK is still part of the customs union. And in fact, it's been at least a five-year period of delay after the transition date for next year before any decisions are made. And in fact, the document apparently has 20XX as the date in which the final things have to resolve. In other words, 2099, we could still be working out what happens and what doesn't happen. I don't think the European Union will exist by 2099. So it's maintained the effective membership within the customs union for the whole of the UK, and that gives Scotland no reason to complain fundamentally.
So that's only 79 years away, though, Steve.
No, it's pretty close. Yeah, you're right.
2099. But okay, so let's, again, for our American audience that won't really fully understand this unless they're part of that small minority that's really paying careful attention. So the free movement of people, in essence, ends, meaning other EU countries' citizens can't just come to the UK and live there, and vice versa, the UK citizens can't in the future going forward, even though there's a temporary respite for people who may be already there or already in other countries, they can't just set up shop and move without prohibition to other EU countries. So the free movement of people ends, but the customs union does what exactly? It means that the British products are being sold within the same EU trade parameters?
Yeah, and vice versa. EU goods get sold in the UK. So there's no change to the trade arrangements. There's no need to adopt World Trade Organization rules. And there's no need for customs checks at Calais. So that means that the basic customs union arrangement continues. The free movement, voluntary free movement, doesn't happen anymore. And to point out to American listeners as to why that matters, if you imagine America having the same structure that the EU has, if somebody moved from Alabama to California, what would happen is that California would have to start paying their pensions and paying their social security payments, and Alabama would stop paying it. And this is what was happening because, in terms of Britain, because the nations are responsible for social security, somebody could move out of a state with high unemployment like Greece or on the periphery Romania and go to Britain and benefit, so much as you could benefit, from the social security of Britain. And that was what people were complaining about. Now, that won't happen anymore, but people have already made that move, who's already resident, you know, you might have a French resident working in London, they've been effectively grandfathered, so they can stay. Whereas one of the scare tactics about Brexit was, oh, if we go for Brexit, anybody who's been living in the UK, courtesy of the arrangement with the European Union, they'll have to leave as soon as Brexit happens. That isn't the case.
And what will it mean for the London banking center? Of course, London became the center in many ways for not the only center, but certainly a developed center for EU banking. Will this hurt or help, or will the status quo for London banks stay about the same?
I think pretty much the status quo. And people talk about, you know, Britain benefiting from being an access point to the European Union for finance. What really gave the Brits the strength in the finance sector is British law and the English language. And that was always going to be the case. If you're going to move financial sectors from in London to Frankfurt, as people were saying, then you'd have to have operations under German law, which is nowhere near as favourable to corporations as British law is, and change the languages as well. So the main advantage is really, I think, had nothing to do with Britain's member of the European Union. It was the British language and British law.
Will Theresa May be able to sell this package? It sounds to me like you think it's the best possible of the available options. And will she be able to hold on as prime minister?
Well, that's a totally different issue, because if you have people who are passionately, in an ideological sense, saying we want to be, you know, passing our own laws, et cetera, et cetera. And if we're still part of the European Customs Union, we can't do that. And on that sole ground, they may well vote to depose Theresa May. Apparently the DUP, the Conservative Protestant group in Northern Ireland, on whose votes May depends, they've been cut out of the discussions. So they may well decide to pull out, or at least to threaten to do so, to get a better deal for their faction in Northern Ireland. And equally, there's no idea which way the Labour Party might go, because, of course, in the Labour Party, there's the Blairite wing that's still trying to sink Jeremy Corbyn, and their decisions will have more to do about how they want to shaft Jeremy Corbyn and get back to a neoliberal Labour Party than it has to do with the deal itself. So calling which way that's going to do in British politics, I'd rather gamble on a roulette wheel.
Steve Keen, 1 minute left. When you think back, the referendum in June 2016, it wasn't expected to go this way. The people who introduced it, meaning the Conservative Party, the Tories, thought it would pass, that people would vote to remain inside the EU. They were stunned by 53-47% vote for leaving. It's been a period of turbulence since then. It's been more than 2 years now. When you look at the whole big picture, will much change for people in the UK with the new arrangement?
I don't think a great deal will change. The one thing that does change, and this actually takes some of the pressure off the Brexit case, is the ending of free movement. So you don't have the allegation that Polish people are coming over and taking advantage of UK welfare. That particular claim can't be made anymore. That particular element of the membership of the European Union looks like it's been addressed by this arrangement. So I think it takes the pressure off. And that, to me, I must admit, I'm rather surprised, because it seems such a shambles. I didn't think anything useful could come out of it. My gut feeling is this is a relatively successful agreement, but whether it will get through British politics, that's anybody's guess.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from London by Steve Keen. Steve is the author of Debunking Economics. He is also the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out and support his work at Patreon. That's patreon.com/ Prof. Steve Keen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jamel Roberson was shot by police in a Chicago suburb earlier this week. He was a 26-year-old African-American father and security guard who was on duty the night a shooter came to the bar where he worked. He successfully had the alleged shooter on the ground when cops got there, but instead of taking that shooter into custody, the cops shot and killed Roberson, the security guard. We're joined from Chicago by Frank Chapman, a longtime organizer with the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Frank, this is an ongoing theme for us, and not just for us, but you know, we see these kinds of reports in the media literally all the time. It's as though, well, here in this case, we have the police getting a report of a shooter. They specifically knew that the shooter was white. They get to the scene. A white man is being held in detention in temporary custody. An African-American man is on top of him, holding him for the cops. And then the knee-jerk reaction is to pull out a weapon and to kill the black man.
I don't think it's a knee-jerk reaction. I think it's an action that is inspired and encouraged by the fact that we have a racist police system in this country. You keep saying black man, and there was a white guy on the ground. And so I can infer from that it was a white cop that shot the black man.
Right. Usually it is it not?
Yeah. I can infer from that because it usually is. Sometimes it's the other way, but it usually is because we're talking about a pattern and a practice of racist discrimination that has existed with the police department all throughout this country for over 100 years. And until we begin to recognize that this is a deep, abiding, systemic problem, we're going to continue to have it. We got to recognize that what it is, and then we got to do something about it, you know. And our approach to this, our organization's approach to this, is that what we need in this country is we need democratic control of the police department. The communities that they police need to be in control of them, because otherwise, what we have going on here, we have like a paramilitary operation going on in the African American communities and the brown communities, and they do these things without fear of impunity, of punishment, you know, with impunity. They do these things, they kill people, and the Supreme Court has given them a way out by saying all they have to do is feel like their lives have been threatened, and the local political authorities give them a way out by accepting whatever they say happened.
That's the voice of Frank Chapman. Frank is a longtime, I would say a legendary organizer with the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou, my co-host. Frank Chapman, we're talking about the police, and you're talking about the police with impunity. They have a license to kill, and they can say at any moment, as you pointed out, and the Supreme Court has upheld this notion that all they have to do is assert that they felt threatened, that they felt that their lives were in danger, and thus they have that license to kill. And we saw this now with Jamel Roberson. I mean, this case in particular, it's not unique because it's so customary, it's so common, but it is sort of an outstanding case too because he was there, he was a hero, he stopped the shooting, stopped what might be a mass killing, and the moment the police get there, the moment they arrive, they shoot him dead. And I have to say, I posted about this on social media, and there was an avalanche of response, and I think that's happening around the country right now, Frank, because people are so outraged by this, not because it's unique, it's too common, but this is there's something so awful about this case and what happened, that this guy who was a hero at the moment of his heroism is shot dead by the police.
Everything reaches a boiling point, and I think that's where we're at in this country right now with regard to these racist-inspired killings that are taking place by the police or executed by the police. And You said it all. They have a license. That license is their badge, you know, and they're approaching it in this manner. They're saying that black people, no matter who they are in society, no matter what their social status, no matter whether they're criminals or they're not criminals, no matter who they are, whether they're part of the law enforcement or not, no matter who they are, that they are automatically suspect and labeled as criminals. So what we have going on here, and it has reached the point now where I hope everybody is starting to recognize it, we have the criminalization of a whole entire community, a race of people, by our system of criminal justice. And that's manifested not only in what the police do on the streets, it's also manifested by who we have in jails. We are not a majority of the population of this country, so why are we represented that way in jails? And police are the cutting edge of mass incarceration. It's like they're the cutting edge of genocide when it comes to our people being killed. Just because the Supreme Court said it's okay doesn't mean it's okay. There's international laws that say that this is not okay. There's UN conventions that says that this is not okay. And so if you're going against international laws, if you're going against international standards of human decency, then what you are doing, you are creating a program that is in its intent and operations is genocidal. They're committing genocide against my people.
That's the voice of Frank Chapman. We're talking to Frank from Chicago about another police execution, this time Jamel Roberson. I want to read, Frank, I want to read an account from what somebody posted. The woman's name is Isabella Alexander. I just want to read a couple sentences for our audience and then get your reaction. Jamel Roberson put his life on the line to stop a mass shooting at Manny's Blue Room Bar in Chicago suburb last night. Not only did he return fire, stopping the shooter, he chased the shooter down the street as he tried to escape, pinning him under his own body weight, and waited for the police to arrive at the scene, ensuring the safety of everyone around him. I don't know many people who would have been so courageous. Do you? Jamal, a beloved son, father, and musician in his community church, worked as a security guard at Manny's, and he dreamed of becoming a police officer one day. He was 26 years old. When the police arrived at the scene, they shot and killed Jamal. As onlookers cried, "He's the security guard. He saved us." I mean, it's pretty gripping.
It's dramatic, and it's inexcusable that the police did not know what was going on.
And it's tragic.
It's tragic. It's for his family, his children, his wife, his parents, his community. And Frank Chapman, you're right. You know, you kind of feel it at different points that the rage, the anger, it does reach a boiling point, and then it erupts, and then perhaps it ebbs, it dies down a little bit, but it never goes away. It seems to me that if there is a momentary lull in the struggle against police violence, this is sure to come back and come back with greater force.
You're absolutely right, my friend. It will come back unless and until we, the people, do something about it. Now, what can we do about it? We have to use what democratic rights we have left to bring about a systemic change in this situation. What we're trying to do here in Chicago, we have an ordinance pending in the city council. We're pushing for an ordinance to create an all-elected, all-civilian police accountability council, which will empower the people in our communities to say who polices their communities and how their communities are policed. This is very important. We can do this. It happened in this country during the era of Black Reconstruction, when the Black slaves were freed and given the right to vote, and they created a new system of government in the South within the bounds of the democratic principles that gave them the authority to say who polices their communities and how their communities are policed, because they had to destroy those paddy patrols. They had to destroy the whole entire policing system that exists under slavery and create a new one. And the only way they could do that was to take charge of the police. Okay, here we are 100 years plus later. We need to do that again.
We're going
to
leave it right there. We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Frank Chapman. Frank is a longtime and legendary organizer in Chicago with the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou and also by Walter Smolarek. He is a producer of this show and also a Sputnik news analyst. We're going to be talking about a student struggle in Colombia. Protesting students in Colombia are preparing for a major demonstration tomorrow as they continue their struggle for adequate funding for the country's higher education. They are facing massive, violent repression from the new far-right government of Iván Duque. We're joined from Bogota, Colombia, by Christian Polo. He's the spokesperson for the National Union of Students and Higher Education at the National University of Colombia in Bogota. Christian Polo, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Walter, this is big. I mean, these students are standing up. They're steadfast. They're continuing their protests. but they're being met with fierce repression by the far right government, the government that, of course, is backed by Donald Trump and the U.S. government.
Yeah, right. John Bolton, you know, when he gave his Troika of Tyranny so-called speech in Miami, he not only said that, well, we want to overthrow the governments of Nicaragua, of Venezuela, of Cuba, he also said, you know, well, there are some governments in the region who we agree with. And he mentioned Brazil, Bolsonaro, and the Colombian government, Ivan Duque. Christian Polo, tell us what the student struggle is all about. What are the demands? What are the grievances with the government?
Okay, well, we have big goals. We have goals in the short term and goals in the long and midterm. So in the short term, we're fighting for more budget for the public university because as a result of neoliberalism, since 1993, the budget for higher education was frozen. The universities had to find their own resources. So that's almost like they have to privatize, increasing costs for students and selling services for private and state companies. So that's for the short term. In long term and mid term, we are demanding for radical transformation of public university policy. So we are fighting for totally free and high quality education.
Yeah, an important struggle and one that's taking place in many places around the world. But the government's reaction has been so brutal. Tell us about what happened just yesterday.
Yeah, well, yesterday we had a demonstration outside the university, the National University of Colombia in Bogota. And when we were holding this demonstration, the police brutally attacked us. And with a helicopter, they were throwing gas to the crowds. So we have some people injured and... Well, this just gets to the Thursday. Just last week was the worst demonstration because we never had so much repression in any other protest before. So now it's getting really hard for students. The government is really worried about how to control this wave because we never have a big movement like this. It's really fun to hear Duque tweets last year supporting students in Venezuela, even when they were really violent and they were burning police officers. And now when the students in Colombia are in the streets peacefully protesting with culture, art, music, and dance, we just get violence from the state.
Yeah, that's a really important point to raise, that double standard there. So this repression, is it accurate? It's being carried out by the Mobile Anti-Disturbances Squadrons, the ESMAD?
Yeah. The ESMAD is... They don't respect human rights. Even yesterday, they put in jail one girl from human rights defenders. So yeah, they don't respect anything. They are the authority, and they want to remember every moment they are the authority with violence.
And these mobile anti-disturbance squadrons, right? The riot police. They've been employed to repress many social movements across Colombia. I mean, for many, many different progressive forces, this is a very dangerous time. Talk about the overall political climate in Colombia, if you would.
In this moment, we have a lot of social movements trying to emerge. Because the government is making some reforms and some politics, which is really bad for the people. And, well, this is the technique, the repression from the ESMAD is the repression, is the technique they have been used for years. One of the strongest movements in Colombia is the indigenous movements. They just, more than 1,000 indigenous get yesterday to Bogota, and they were received in the entrance of the city with the repression of the ESMAD. So yeah, that's the technique for the government. So they can keep us like control, and they don't want us to get streets and demonstrate. They're trying to get demonstrations illegal by the constitution. They want that by one reform. So we are fighting really strong with these reforms, and we are keeping in the struggle to higher education and a better country for us.
Yeah, let's talk about those reforms. So are you referring to the defense minister's comments talking about, basically criminalizing protests?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I remember seeing news about that when he first floated that possibility. And I mean, it's so disturbing considering sort of the overall politics of the Duque administration. Yeah, what kind of challenge does that pose to really democracy itself in Colombia?
We cannot say nothing about Venezuela. We can say nothing about Venezuela because we're the country. It's really bad now, and we have really bad like administrations, not only in the national administrations but local administrations. So it wasn't only the defense minister, but also the mayors of the most of the cities of Colombia. They are trying to stop demonstrations in the street, so they want to get illegal all the protests. They want that illegal, so they are trying to make a reform locally and nationally to stop the struggle.
Yeah, it's a highly disturbing development. So talk about this demonstration that's coming up tomorrow, and I believe there's also one on November 28th. What are those actions going to be demanding? What do you anticipate?
Okay, yeah, we're still demanding to sit in a table with the government to talk about the necessary reforms that the university needs, but also we are trying to get alliances with other social movements like indigenous or teachers, also workers, trade unions, which they are also against Duque politics. So we have a big demonstration for tomorrow. We call it the Pensil demonstrations. And also we have a big demonstration for the next week, the 28th. All these demonstrations are it's really for all the social movements which are supporting now education, and we are getting bigger and bigger every week. And this strike is going to last a long time if government don't respond to our needs.
Yeah, the student movement throughout Latin America has sort of shown its ability to be, in some cases, sort of like the prime mover in politics in certain cases, like in the 2011 Chilean students movement, you know, the struggle in Mexico. So talk about sort of the power of the student movement to, I guess what I'm saying is what is the role of the student movement in this broader struggle for the progressive transformation of society? What role can students play?
Yeah, the students movement, it is, if you can see history of Latin America, you can see when in one country the student movement is in protest, then it gets like in every country around, there starts to be some students protest. So in this moment, Colombia, but also Peru is trying to give this struggle, and Argentina is in this struggle too. Mexico is trying to get stronger in the movement. So students are the force and the brain of the progressive forces in Latin America. We have a proposal for country. We discuss the country where politics involved in other movements. So we are not only fighting for students' things, because the students' movement is also aligned with indigenous, with peasants, with teachers, with workers. So we are a really big network, and we have a lot of connections with a lot of others, politics and social movements in the country, and in Latin America it's almost the same. So we are a really big strong, and we are a big strength to transform this country.
We have just about 1 minute left. You know, the United States for a long time has been a principal backer of the Colombian governments, right? You know, not just the Duque administration, but many, many going back, providing military aid to you know, different military units involved in human rights abuses. You know, what's your message to progressive people here in the United States who want to be in solidarity with the struggle of all people in Colombia?
Well, I want to say that we need solidarity with videos, letters, or anything that could prevent any event or any violent event. Also, we want more and more people outside that can get to know the importance of public education in Colombia and Latin America, and that they can solidarize with the students and our struggle, which is a struggle not only for us, but for the people of Colombia, which don't have the opportunity to access to the education.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from Bogota, Colombia by Christian Polo. He is the spokesperson for the National Union of Students in Higher Education at the National University of Colombia in Bogota. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear. Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump today named the former commander of Central Command, General John Abizaid, as the new ambassador to Saudi Arabia. The appointment came as a surprise, as Abizaid has no known direct ties to Trump, and the Saudis insist that any U.S. ambassador be a direct line to the president. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Always good to have you, Ali.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Ali, I know John Abizaid, and I like and respect John Abizaid, which makes me wonder why in the world John Abizaid was named ambassador to Saudi Arabia. What do you think?
Well, I think, this was actually maybe one of the best choices that American presidents have made, you know, found somebody who is actually maybe not a political appointee. From the time of Bush until now, we have always had political appointees, and John Abizaid is not close to politically to Trump. So it is, I think, maybe a better choice in terms of the professional way to do it. But I think this has to do with two things. Number one, the fact that he's from the military and he knows the area. He's been there. He's originally from Lebanon. His parents are. And also realize that the greatest transactional relationship between the United States and the Saudi monarchy today is arms sales, and so they need somebody with that knowledge who is able to do that, to continue doing that transaction. Secondly, a person with regional military experience like Abizaid has that. In order to work with the Saudi monarchy vis-a-vis Iran. And I think that choice is actually, from a professional standpoint, it's probably the best choice. And in addition, I'm not certain, but many of these people are connected to the arms dealers and companies.
John Kiriakou, it's interesting what Ali is telling us, that part of the criteria for a U.S. ambassador, we know Jared Kushner has been the de facto ambassador for the Trump administration for the past 2 years.
That's right.
Talking to the Saudis and Prince Mohammed bin Salman regularly, maybe daily. But Ali is making the point that you have to know a great deal about the transactional character of the relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis, especially as it has to do with weapon sales. Mm-hmm. Abizaid has a particular expertise in that.
He does. Interestingly enough, after graduating from West Point, he got a master's degree from Harvard University in Middle Eastern studies. But then he got a PhD in which he did his dissertation on Saudi weapons purchases.
That's his PhD?
His PhD was on Saudi weapons purchasing policy. It's incredibly specific. I was joking with you off the air that I don't even know where you find enough information on such a thing to warrant a PhD dissertation. But I also have to agree with Ali. This is a surprisingly inspired choice to be ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Not only is he wildly qualified, but he's respected on both sides of the aisle. And interestingly, on Iran, he gave a speech, a very controversial speech, at the Center for Strategic and International Studies a couple of years ago, in which he said that we can live with a nuclear Iran, that he prefers that Iran not develop nuclear weapons. But in the event that they did, we have lived with a nuclear Soviet Union and Russia, a nuclear China, other nuclear powers. It's not the end of the world if the Iranians develop a nuclear weapon. We're speaking here from Washington with Ali Al-Ahmed, who's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, I wonder, in light of this close relationship between Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Jared Kushner, if there's a possibility that the Saudi royal family might try to go around Abizaid and deal directly with Kushner in order to go directly to Trump. Do you think that might be a problem?
It could be a problem. However, I think Abizaid is not a person that will allow that to happen. I don't think the Saudis will be able to move around. And I think this is a choice that is amazingly surprising. Honestly, you can disagree with Trump as much as you want, but this is one of the maybe best choices he had made ever in his administration. And I would give this an A+ in terms of the qualification of Abizaid. And if you compare him to all the previous combined, and this is my view, combined, he is better than all of them combined in terms of his qualification and his capacity to deal with the issues facing that relationship.
Ali, I wonder if, in fact, the nomination in this case for Abizaid really doesn't come from within the White House, but instead comes from James Mattis and the Pentagon Uniformed Officer Corps. What do you think?
It is possible. It is possible that Mattis suggested him. They are Mattis and Abizaid are friends. In fact, so I think this could have been something that Mattis brought up or told Pompeo about him, and Pompeo agreed. And they supported that choice.
Yeah, let me add something there, too. At any given time, there are only about 14 or 16 four-star generals in the U.S. military. It's a small community. They all know one another. They all work together. We're talking about Mattis. We're talking about Kelly. We're talking about Abizaid. And so Ali's right. These guys all know each other. And this suggestion, at least, probably did come from either Mattis or Kelly or both.
And that's the other thing, Ali. So Trump has been, you know, the driver of U.S.-Saudi policy since he's been president. That doesn't mean it's that different from other U.S. presidents. But there's been a particular character to the Trump-Saudi relationship. It was the first country he went to after he assumed the White House, the office of the presidency. Now we have, after the killing of Khashoggi, a change, though, a reshuffling. Perhaps a reshuffling of power inside of the Saudi royal family. And there are obviously elements within the U.S. larger establishment, writ large, including the Pentagon, who don't want to peg all of U.S.-Saudi relations simply to the crown prince, to Mohammed bin Salman. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. I think right now it appears that the American administration realizes that it cannot really possibly deal just with one power in the country. For many years, I have been talking to State Department and saying that, you know, there is more than the royal families in our country. There are, you know, different regions, different people. So it is better for you and it's wiser to deal with all these powers. Although they are not in the government, you have to deal with the military, for example. You have to deal with the tribes and the regions and different social and political elements in the country. That was not something that they wanted to do. Maybe now there is a change, that they need somebody who's strong and actually capable. And I can tell you many of the, and I knew many of them, they were not qualified to be, and some of them were actually more so the Saudi ambassadors to the United States than the opposite. And these are the words of a former national security senior official who is a friend, who told me that they, when former ambassador, who's dead now, von Fraker, comes to the White House, he sounded like he's working with the Saudis, not for us. This is during the Bush administration. So, and I can tell you so many examples of how that happened. So you are really looking at, I think, a good choice made, you know, and let's see what happens. He's very strong and capable and he has more experience than all the ambassadors before him combined in terms of the region and of this relationship.
Ali, I want to ask you a broader question about Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi royal family. After the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, we know that Mohammed bin Salman, at least according to the Washington Post, called Jared Kushner in surprise and said, why is everybody so upset about this guy's death? They couldn't understand, the Saudis couldn't understand, and specifically Mohammed bin Salman, why anybody would care about Khashoggi's death, not thinking that he's a U.S. resident, he's a green card holder, and he's a columnist for the Washington Post. There was briefly talk that there could be a challenge to Mohammed bin Salman from inside the royal family, and a couple of news outlets here in the United States mentioned Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, one of the last sons, the youngest sons of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz ibn Saud. Do you think that there's any role for Ahmed to play? He was just released from house arrest at the Ritz-Carlton not too long ago. Or is he finished?
No, Ahmed bin Abdulaziz was not ever arrested.
Oh, he was not? My mistake.
No, he was in London for vacation, and he was asked to come back, and he came back. He is the youngest son, or youngest brother of King Salman. But when he was interior minister, which is a powerful position, he was not able to do anything. He is not really a threat. He is not a possibility. And I think I know some people are hoping to replace him or put him instead of Mohammed bin Salman. I think that ship has sailed already, and he doesn't have the gumption and the capacity to do it. Mohammed bin Salman, like him or hate him, is the man to beat. And so far, there is no competition within the ruling family. He has all the facets of power. In Saudi Arabia, in order to have a shot at the throne, you need to have some, you know, what I call a militia. You either your security force, the Ministry of the Interior, or the Ministry of Defense, or the National Guards. All of these security and military forces are in the hand of Mohammed bin Salman, not anybody else. So there is no way he can compete with him. And the king is not capable, even if he wanted, to remove his own son. It's done. It's a done deal.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Ali Al-Ahmed. He's the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, and he joined us from Washington. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.
Oh,